Hey friends, couple things really quick before we get started here. First of all, I was a guest on a podcast called TJTV. The way that's spelled is capital TJAY space TV. It's a podcast that this guy TJ Gleason's been doing for a long time, and he just talks to people at length about whatever. He lives in Philadelphia. I met him through Chrissy Bear, who mixes and masters the show. We talked about the album. We talked about politics. We talked about 2020 and COVID-19. We talked about depression, and it got real. It got deep. If you want to go listen to that, his show is only on Spotify. It's not on Apple Podcasts. So if you've got Spotify and you want to go listen to that interview, again, capital TJAY space TV, TJTV. The episode, I think, is just my name, Austin Archer. So you can go listen to that. Second thing is the show, People Pleaser, is a year old. As of the date that you're listening to this, People Pleaser has been releasing episodes for a full calendar year. It's crazy. I can't even believe it. Next week, we're going to be doing like a big 1 year extravaganza blowout, but in acknowledgement of that 1 year, I want to get back to this. I want to reach out to you, members of the Blanket Nation, members of the Blanket Fort Nation, and implore those of you who have not already to consider going to Apple Podcasts and giving this show a 5-star rating. That's that purple podcast app that you have. Go to Apple Podcasts and give the show a 5-star rating and review the show. And as you'll remember, what I like to do with those is I like to read those reviews on the air and review you back. I want to do some more of those, especially in honor of the show's 1-year anniversary. I'm really proud of the show. I'm happy we made it this far, and we wouldn't have made it this far without all of you being here week after week supporting the show. It really means a lot to me. So if you would, help us, boost the show algorithmically, and let's really move this show into let's get some more members of our little Blanket Fort cult here. let's grow the numbers of our sweet little organization we got going on here, and you can help do that by rating the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, leaving a review, that's it. Listen to TJTV, go rate the show, and here's my conversation with Cooper Howell. When you actually sit down to take a look at it, it truly is astonishing how much of our experience is shaped by expectations. The expectations other people have for us, the expectations we have for ourselves, the expectations we have for other people, and of course the expectations we have for life in general or the universe. The expectations others have for us usually take the form of people thinking, well, you were born in such and such place to a family that looks like this with parents who earn that dollar amount. So based on the given circumstances present at your birth, we expect you to behave like this, believe approximately these things, and accomplish precisely this much. Depending on whether that equation works out to people having high, low, or average expectations of you, it can all be damaging in different fun ways. Low expectations, for instance, can result in society not recognizing your loftier aspirations as realistic or legitimate, therefore making it difficult to achieve those things. Whereas high expectations could potentially result in a psychological condition where you constantly feel like you are underachieving and letting the entire world down because despite being born into the lap of privilege and opportunity, you have failed every day since the day you were born to cure cancer or create world peace. And average expectations, well, can result in you just feeling meaningless or invisible. Like, nobody really expects anything of you, so why would you expect anything of yourself? Now, if you're anything like me, then the expectations you have for other people create a much simpler equation. It goes something like this. Other people interact with me, the protagonist of all human life, They should therefore acknowledge my needs and desires without me having to tell them and treat me accordingly. Honestly, I'm not sure any of my expectations get me into more trouble than my horribly unrealistic expectations of others. Other people pretty much never behave the way I expect them to, and learning to be okay with that is something I'm becoming more and more convinced might just be one of the essential building blocks to a truly happy existence. Now, my expectations of myself seem to vary on a day-to-day, sometimes moment-to-moment basis, depending on how I feel. Sometimes I feel inspired, like I have all the tools I need to create art the way I want to and to craft the kind of life, the kind of relationships, the kind of energy I feel like I'm capable of crafting. In these moments, my expectations of myself can get rather high. Not in a necessarily negative way, more in a hopeful and encouraging way. But then there are days where productivity is this elusive dream I feel like I remember having once, and all I can really expect from myself is to brush my teeth and stretch. I need to be really flexible on my expectations for myself. The bad days are when I expect myself to do a lot, but only have the energy for the brushing and stretching. Now, my expectations of the universe are perhaps my most difficult to pin down, but also the ones that I think cause me the most pain. I believe that there is a natural cause and effect that I should be able to predict and control. If I put X amount of work into a project, the result should be a fixed outcome. But in life, that's just not how it works. Because in order for me to control and predict my outcomes, I would have to be able to control the attitudes of everyone around me, and as we've already established, that is a superpower that I simply do not possess. So we're left with this sea of frustratingly unfulfilled expectations. What do we do with that? Is it possible to rid ourselves of these expectations? Is that the goal? To live free of expectations? I'm honestly not sure if that's possible, but I do think that there may be some form of antidote or good medicine that could at least make the expectations more palatable. So if expectations are the problem, then the medicine, it seems, might simply be acceptance? Learning to accept and acknowledge the beauty in what is, rather than pining over the unfulfilled expectations of what might have been. I say all of this, of course, as a person who has mastered none of this. And that's why I'm gonna hash it out with my friend. So let's do it. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my very good friend, actor, writer, director, choreographer, all the things are Cooper Howell about expectations. One, two, three.
Yay, we did it. So in sync, too.
That is so funny. So I've done this a few times over FaceTime with people, and on their end, it's in sync, and on my end, it's like a second delayed.
Oh, really?
So it actually shows that it's a good thing to do so that I can then try to find like a mid-ground between the two when I get the audio.
But yeah, I felt that was pretty in sync.
That's what they tell me.
I was more of a Backstreet Boys fan myself, but... That was dumb. Anyway, hello.
Hey, how
What's
are
up?
You?
I'm good.
New
how
York.
Are you? New York City.
I'm good.
Yep.
What's it like out there right now? I know that has it chilled out, or is it still like pretty gnarly?
You know what? Like, honestly, living in New York during the pandemic was just a total... an amazing firsthand experience of experiencing how bullshit media is, because I would get frantic phone calls from my family and friends who were like, New York is like The Walking Dead right now. It's insane. And I've been in New York the whole time and it's been fine. It literally is fine. In fact, New York is now like kind of normal. It's just everyone's wearing a face mask, you know? I don't feel like it's been gnarly at all. It started as a ghost town, and then it got really heightened during the Black Lives Matter revival. And now it's just totally, totally normal. So
normal for New York, which is, there's always a little chaos going on.
Yeah, normal for New York, where like death is always a couple feet away, and like, you know, there's millions of people running about, but you know, like that fucking... Oh, I'm allowed to swear, right? It's...
Yeah.
Okay, great. That fucking...
My parents don't like it, but you can swear.
I'm so sorry, brother and sister Archer. the Mike Pence-Kamala Harris debate where... Oh, no, it was the Donald Trump debate where he was like, look at what happened to New York. It's so sad and blah, blah, blah. It's like... And everyone in New York was like, what are you talking about? We're fine. They just open restaurants. So... Yeah,
you know, that's funny. That's funny that you say that about like the media misrepresenting what life is like in a place like that. And it shows that, because I took a road trip with my friends to the Pacific Northwest a few weeks ago, and this was before the fires happened. But everyone was like, God, what a year we live in. Everything's like, this was before, like, this is before, this is before the murder hornets of the plague. This was when we were still, but
I was going to say, like, what Pacific Northwest? That doesn't,
it doesn't exist anymore, right? It's been wiped off the map.
Yeah.
But I was telling everyone, I'm like, yeah, we're going to Seattle. We're going to Portland. And everyone was like, you're going to Portland right now? You're going to Seattle? Like, you're going to go into the teeth of that, like, insane. Yeah. And I was like, you know, like hundreds of thousands of people live there, right? Like it's not.
Yeah, like people, a barren wasteland. Yeah, it's like.
People are still going to work every day in Portland and Seattle. Like we're not going to.
A highly populated area, right.
Yeah. We're not going to roll into town and like have our car immediately attacked by like a Mad Max style roving band of like scavengers, you know, like.
I will say though that the Pacific Northwest now has gotten. Like the homeless problem in Portland is out of this world. It is.
Oh, that's everywhere. That's Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle. It's gnarly in Portland and Seattle. It really
is. Well, and San Francisco is like the number one worst. I mean, it is. It's terrifying. I had friends that were in Hamilton in San Francisco, and they were like talking about how they felt like they were risking their lives just going to the theater because they had to like walk through downtown, which is just like such a scary place right now. But.
In Portland, it's not illegal to camp anywhere if you have a tent. So you can just set up a camp in downtown.
And it kind of feels that way in Salt Lake too, right?
Well, it feels that way in Los Angeles. Like it's not technically legal to do that in Los Angeles. Like there's tent cities everywhere.
Right.
And there's tent cities everywhere in Seattle. Right. There was a little setup in Seattle that like I honestly was like, I don't know. That looks pretty chill. Like it was like, it was like one of those like
a commune
little, but you know, those little spots of land that are sometimes in the middle of like intersections where like, it's like a five-way intersection. So there's like a little piece of concrete and like maybe some grass like in the middle of an intersection. Someone had like claimed one of those as like an island, and they had like a fence built up around it, and they had like chairs and a tent, and we walked by it, and there were like 10 people kind of sitting in there in chairs, like smoking and chatting and drinking beer and like hanging out. And I was like, I don't know. They've got like a little barbecue going on here, like in this guy's backyard. He lives in an intersection, but like he's got his friends over, and like he's got, you know, I was like, oh, that doesn't look too bad. Like, it's like he's
go to one of those and tell me how it is. And if it's popping, I'll join. You know?
See what it's like to try to sleep when you live in an intersection.
God. Yeah. Or if a car flips over, like good luck, you know.
Right. If there's a car accident in your house.
Yeah.
which is a tent.
Which is common, you know.
Okay. So but what's interesting about that to me is that what we hear so much from the right is about the fake liberal news, the fake liberal media.
Oh, God.
What I think is actually more accurate about the media is that their bias just leans toward good stories. And so, like, it's not really like a political bias. It's just like what's going to get people to watch longer.
Yeah.
And so the whole coverage of the Black Lives Matter revival was like, everything's a riot. Everything is like, look how violent these protests are. Where like 99.9% of the protests happening across the world were wildly peaceful.
Correct.
Where everyone was just like walking, dancing to music, mm-hmm. holding signs with like big love messages on them. It was like love fests across the world.
It was actually unbelievably fun. It was unbelievably fun. And that's something that I like couldn't quite explain to like my Utah friends, right? Where they have this picture of it just being like, you know, smashed windows, and you know, there was some of that. There really was, but those experiences were so outlier. You know what I mean? They're so few and far between. And I went to maybe, I don't know, 15 to 20, maybe more protests, and they were all just like unbelievably organized. And the ones that weren't unbelievably organized, it felt like a parade. It felt like a parade through the city, and everyone was just, you know, angry, but it was peaceful still. And I just don't understand the purpose of switching that news story to having it be something that it isn't. Well, I do understand. It's called racism, and it's existed for forever. But,
yeah, how many cameras did you see at the peaceful, know, like fun protests that you went to?
A bunch.
Like news cameras?
Yeah. But they were advertised.
I guess in New York, yeah.
It was advertised as something different a lot of the times. You know what I mean? Like, so they would like show the exact same footage and like play like weird music over it and, you know, shaky cam it, or, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, Mary and I went to a couple in Salt Lake because we were in Salt Lake in like April or May.
Oh God, what was that like?
And
they were really beautiful. One we did, we marched like 6 miles in the pouring rain to the place where Bernardo Palacios was killed on 9th South and 9th West.
Yeah.
And we went from the Capitol down to there. And that one was like really somber and like sad. And it was like, we're marching in the rain. We're like soaking wet. Mm-hmm. And it was like very like, but it was still like very peaceful. And then we did one that was a 10 mile dance party around Salt Lake. And we walked 10 miles behind this truck that was booming music, and everyone was just dancing the entire time.
Wow.
And it's like, it was like 5,000, like, or no, not 5,000. It was like 500 people dancing and through Salt Lake. And it was so beautiful, and we had such a good time. But one thing we noticed is we were like, there's no news here. There's no news trucks covering this, because it's just it's not a sensational enough story to come and watch us all dancing and having a good time.
Sure.
And like, and it was the Black Lives Matter organization in Salt Lake had just decided, they were like, everyone's been having like a lot of, it's been a really hard few weeks, and we just want to have like a little bit of like a fun one, you know, like let everyone just sort of still have the message, still make sure that we're clear on message, but like, let's have a little love fest.
Sure.
And stuff like that just doesn't get coverage. And I don't think that it's necessarily because the news is skewed one way or the other politically. I think it's just about like, what's going to engage viewers? Like what's going to like make people scared? What's going to like, you know?
Sure.
And absolutely that has ties to racism as well. And just not wanting to give the movement its fair shake in the news, and being like, it's largely a peaceful movement.
Sure.
The violent protests tend to come like in the wee hours after an incident has happened, when there's not time to get a permit, and like people are like, cool, well, we're going to go take to the streets, and we don't have a permit, and the cops are going to show up, and that's fine. And
did you just hear, I think it was yesterday, Donald Trump said in a news conference that the Black Lives Matter organization is a Marxist organization, and that it is racist.
What does that even mean?
Inherently racist. I mean, that's just like a bunch of hot button Fox News words, you know?
Yeah, Marxism, communism, yeah, socialism. We just say this about anything.
Yeah,
that is.
Yeah.
What? Yeah.
Oh wow! Is the theme of our podcast today racism? Is this what we're going to talk about?
We're going to, I think we can tie it into what we're talking about.
Sure, sure.
Because I think what I wanted to talk to you about, expectations,
yeah,
and like learning to deal, to manage expectations,
sure,
doesn't just deal with our careers as artists. It does deal with our careers as artists,
yeah,
but there's all kinds of expectations in the world where you think, oh, hey, we elected Barack Obama president. Like, I have an expectation now that the country, yeah, is on an upward trajectory,
right,
where this is now a watershed moment where it's a before and after moment. And we, yeah, are now after the first black president, which means there's no going backward from this, but we always backslide.
Yeah.
And the realization from a Trump presidency is like, the world doesn't work according to our
timeline. And I feel like I love that we're talking about this, about racism in terms of expectations, because, well, let me completely backtrack. A, thanks for having me on your podcast.
Yeah.
B, I feel like racism is expectations. It's bad expectations put on someone because of the color of their skin. And I think, mm-hmm, you know, I grew up in Utah, in the mountains, by Mormons. I'm adopted, so my parents are also white. And the first black person I had ever met and got to know was LaToya Cameron when
she's
was
been on
23. So yep. I didn't really have any expectations for what was possible for me because, my whole life was already sort of given to me by all of my peers because I was the only person of color that they saw around them.
Yeah.
So what I thought I was capable of coming out of high school versus what everybody else thought I was capable of were two completely different things. And because I was the only brown person, a lot of my friends and people who I knew in high school knew, they put all of their racial expectations on me. Like when the basketball coach asked me basically every day if I would be on the team or if he, and when I was like, no, he'd be like, oh, it's such a shame because you guys are so good at basketball. You know?
Like,
what? Yeah. Yeah. This is Highland, Utah, right? Like the closest that basketball coach got to a black person was on, you know, fucking the TV, right? And so learning what my actual capabilities are and what I expect of myself and unwashing sort of like everybody's racial expectations of me that I grew up with has been like a gigantic theme of my life.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting talking about your friends' expectations of what you are capable of and what you should be doing versus your own.
Right.
Go into that a little bit. What do you mean by that? Do you mean that they had a view of like, oh, Cooper's going to do this, 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 and this, but then you had to realize on your own that what you were actually more interested in was...
Well, okay, so being as specific as possible, I've always been into performing. Always, right? Always, yeah. always. And I specifically in high school was into choir. I was into dance, but I was really, really fucking into theater and into like creating stories and whatnot. And my first day of high school, the drama teacher came up to me and was like, oh, thank God we can finally do Of Mice and Men. Or was it Of Mice and Men or was it To Kill a Mockingbird? I can't remember. It was one of them.
It would probably be To Kill a Mockingbird.
To Kill a Mockingbird, yeah. Because, yeah, we finally have a black person. We can do this black show. And so when I would audition for things, you know, I would audition for the Shakespeare team and I'd audition with like a funny monologue. and they'd be like, here's a monologue from Othello.
Of course.
And I, and so my expectation was, if I was going to be on that stage in drama in high school, I was going to either be playing a black person or a servant of some kind. And if the play or musical involved a family, forget it. I wouldn't get one of those parts because, like, if our school did, say, Next to Normal, right? I couldn't be the dad. I couldn't be the son. But I could be, like, the boyfriend, maybe, right? Because it would just be too awkward for Utah audiences to see me be a family member, and they would have to get another black person to be in it too. And where would they find that black person? And yada, 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 yada. This is, of course, our high school that did Aida with an all-white cast who all went tanning and braided their hair, and also did Once on This Island, where they all got spray tans before and everyone was white. And I was the only black person in it. And then I got kicked out of it because I was a little piece of shit. But that is neither here nor there. But
yeah,
so
I really hate the fact that I did West Side Story in college and that I went tanning and painted my mustache black and drew in black sideburns so I could be a Puerto Rican boy named Indio.
Well,
I did do that. I did.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go ahead and just say that I apologize to everyone.
That is so Utah, though, right?
It's so Utah.
That's so Utah. I feel like any actor that comes from Utah. I know. Yeah. Well, as of like 2019, black people weren't like, or racism wasn't really a thing that we wanted to talk about ever. You know?
Well, in the arts, it's really interesting. This is very similar to like what LaToya shared with me when she came on the show. She talked to me about like how in college she went and auditioned for Seussical, and they were like, so you're going to be Sour Kangaroo. And she was like, well, I'd like to audition for Gertrude. And they were like, sure, you can read that, but like, you're going to be Sour Kangaroo.
Right.
And like this kind of thing where it's like the arts, we feel like we're very open to diversity and inclusion, but it's always on white people's terms. It's always on like, oh no, we already have a pre-made role for you. We already have a designated position for you in this show. Mm-hmm. And you're the only person here who can fulfill that.
Right.
So like, you will, when you show up to audition for Spelling Bee, you'll be auditioning for Mitch Mahoney. Like, that's who you, they're like, oh, can I audition for Leif Coneybear? It's like, oh no, Leif is a white boy. It's like, where does it say that in the script? Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that, you know? And it also doesn't say that Mitch Mahoney is black. It says that he is there as on his parole. Like that, like he, so like,
wow.
It's
racist.
It's, you know what I mean?
Yikes.
You know what I mean? Like,
yikes,
it doesn't say he's black. Yeah. Like, it says that per the conditions of his parole, he has to come and be this, like, the guy who hands out the juice box.
Sure.
So.
I just feel like with my career in particular, I've had to do a ton of work of being like, okay, I am capable of playing so many other things besides the color of my skin, which I don't really have much of a connection to. I mean, unfortunately and fortunately, or just whatever, I identify more with being white than I do with being black. And that's because I was raised by white people and I am half white, right? So technically I am white, but because I'm brown in America, I'm black. If you're like any part brown, you're black. And so my expectations of myself in terms of my career have had to change and be like, you know what, Cooper, if you want to play Hamlet, you can play Hamlet. You know, if you want to play the son in Next to Normal, you can play it, instead of like looking at a casting notice and being like, oh, they'll never cast me as this because because of the color of my skin. And unfortunately, what you realize when you grow up and you do get into that professional world is, even though some of that stereotyping and expectation that was put on you when you were a kid is false and stereotypical, it's actually just a microcosm of something that actually exists at large, right? Where the industry is still very, very racist. It's just racist in a very more subtle way, or and sometimes not as subtle, but having to navigate that and be like, okay, I mean, I just think it's interesting where I realized I did this last year, where someone would tell me a story or pitch me a script of a something, and immediately I would think of the main characters as white. Immediately, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's so fucked up, but that's
without
just...
Without even realizing that that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their names just, are like Jim and Becky.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, and yeah. It's a love story and it takes place, blah, 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 blah. And they're like telling me the story and I'm picturing, okay, so it's Brad Pitt and Reese Witherspoon and they, you know what I mean? I just,
yeah.
You never, and that's so, it's not only fucked up, but then if they're like, then you have to clarify if one of them is a person of color, you know? Oh, right. And we want like this black person to play the guy. Where it's like, but like, why did you have to clarify that? Like, couldn't it just be like a person? You know what I'm saying? But
right.
I don't know.
Yeah. The new thing is like any ethnicity is like what it says when in character descriptions, you know, but I feel like that's the safest thing to do as a writer now is like, I have to be clear that like any ethnicity, but then it's also like sometimes when you are writing a character, that's like a specific, like a person of color in a specific way. It's like you're writing about a specific experience. You're like, well, I have to be specific.
Yeah.
If being Asian American is part of this character's like identity and part of like what creates their worldview, then I have to be specific.
Sure.
Which it's tough, but that thing right there of automatically assuming that protagonists are white. I definitely have that when I read plays. I see myself in a lot of roles when I'm reading. I go like, oh, I could play this part. You know, I want to talk a little bit about, so you're from Utah, you're raised, you know, very white town, LDS. You go to school at the University of Utah where you get to come into a little bit more of a sense of yourself. You get to experience like being a director and stuff. I'm jumping ahead here because there's a really great story that you shared a while back in the wake of George Floyd and everything, and people were talking about diversity in theater. I think this is a great way of talking about what you were talking about, of recontextualizing what you're capable of and what kind of roles you can play. You get an opportunity that's really an incredible opportunity because it's the
Frozen.
It's like the biggest Frozen. It's the biggest thing. You know, it's going to be this major Broadway hit. You know that they're going to workshop the show here and take it to Broadway, and that you have a chance of parlaying this into a Broadway debut.
Sure.
And talk about this a little bit. You get to play.
Yeah. So I got an audition to do, I think it was at this time. So Frozen had just come out, and it was the biggest thing that had ever happened. I mean, like, do you remember 2013, 2014, and there wasn't a single moment of any day where you didn't hear Let It Go? I mean, it was just like fucking everywhere, right? And so,
I mean, luckily I didn't have a 5-year-old or 6-year-old daughter, so I was able to avoid it somewhat, but I still was a musical theater person, so it still was everywhere.
Well, I didn't have a daughter either. I just felt like I was hearing that song constantly. And I had moved to LA around 2015. This was 2016, and I auditioned for a Frozen musical workshop. And the part that they were bringing me in for originally was ensemble. So I was like, cool, whatever. I don't really know what this is. So I went and auditioned for it. And I walk into the room and the creative team was like completely people of all different colors. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I sang my song. It went well. I went home and I got almost immediately an email saying that they wanted to bring me in for Prince Hans. And would I look at this material? And I was like, there's absolutely no way that Disney's going to allow me to play a prince. And again, this is just like my conditioning, right? This is just how my brain works. Like I am not going to play a Disney prince. Like, that is just, like, nothing in my personal history had ever given me, you know, and I had played a lot of roles by this point that that had nothing to do with the color of my skin. So I knew that that was possible. But, like, you know, in Utah, if they wanted to do a show that involved a black guy, they would call me And if I wasn't available, they'd call Carlton Bluford or vice versa. You know what I mean? And so like me and Carlton have probably played every single black role in musical theater that there is to offer because one of us had to do it. And so so I just like knew that I wasn't going to get Prince Hans. I just thought like, okay, they're just looking at me for this because, you know, like that'd be fun. But in reading the packet of it, I was like, oh, I can 100% play this part. But again, I'm like, I'm a colored person. So I walk into that callback and I just fucking like, I fucking put my dick in it. You know, I just like really just like I did that fucking thing. And I like,
I can't believe you just said that.
I really did. I just like, I was like, if I'm not going to get it, I'm going to have fun. And the callback was specifically like that evil monologue he gives where he's like,
I
knew that blah, 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 blah. And I just went like full fucking evil with it.
Isn't that the way we get cast though?
Yeah, is by when we
feeling
don't care.
Like we're not gonna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yep. Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway,
and then I got the call that I got it, and I just it felt like I was picked up out of my life and dropped into somebody else's. Like it really like it did not hit me until I walked into that rehearsal hall and there was like the 3,000 people auditioned for that and they only picked 120. And so,
this is for the callback.
This is for the actual production. So what they were doing,
because it's double cast. Was it 60 in each cast?
No, there were 6 people for each role. There are 6 people for each role. So it started out as
I'm thinking like, holy smokes, 120 people is a lot of people.
Yeah, so they built it for Disneyland. This was Frozen live at the Hyperion and they were taking parts of it and moving to Broadway. So we didn't quite know what our relationship to the Broadway musical was, and which eventually was revealed to us that there was no connection. But we didn't know that at the time. They were just like building it on us and seeing what parts they liked and we're going to blah, 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 blah. But anyway, I was chosen to be one of the full-time Hanses. So it was like me and this other guy were originating this role of Prince Hans. And it was unbelievable. We had a black, Liesl Tommy was our director. She is the first African-American woman to be nominated for a Tony for directing. Yeah. She directed Eclipsed, and she just finished directing the Aretha Franklin biopic with Jennifer Hudson that's coming out.
That looks incredible.
It looks so good. That's her, like,
and
film debut.
Eclipsed.
Eclipsed was great. I mean, that really fucked me up. And my expectations of what I was capable of and what I could play because of the color of my skin, it, like, that experience fully blew up. Like it blew up my it blew up that part of me that just thought, oh, okay, like the color of my skin's gonna hold me back for my entire career. Like, and because I was able to do that, it totally washed that away until she left
suddenly,
and we got a white director.
Exactly. So you've got this expectation that, oh, now, again, so it's this thing of like, oh, I see, I can be anything now.
Uh-huh.
Like there's an expectation that's built up of like,
uh-huh,
I'm accepted. I'm now part of the team.
Yeah.
I get to play a character, not just a black character, but just an actual character and I get to bring nuance and depth to this villain. And I get to like, and it's not, I'm not just playing the part because they needed a black guy to play. I'm playing the part because they liked me as an actor and because they they liked the choices that I made. I'm really playing on a level playing field. You've got this expectation. Maybe things are different than I perceived them, and now
and so, also I just realized too in this moment I had gotten so used to tapping inside of myself that feeling of, oh, the color of my skin, it's so unfair the way I'm treated. Like I had to play that aspect of so many characters so many times that it was interesting to be able to play a part and especially one who's so evil, and to explore why he was evil and have that have nothing to do with any outward appearance, right?
Sure.
It was just all like, I had like created this whole backstory about like emotional abuse from his dad and like blah, 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 blah. And none of that had to do with race. And it was so interesting being able to walk out on stage and not have to be like, you know, like crying over Sarah's body or like, you know, fucking about to go kill Desdemona or some bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
But then Liesl left because she's, you know, Liesl, famous, whatever.
Yeah.
And we got this other director who came in, and on our first note session, the girl that was playing Anna with me, who was also black, he pulled us into a room and told us that when we did the show together, we were too urban. And so that really started. Yeah. It started about a year-long process of intense micro and sexual aggressions towards me, which then just kind of reinforced all of the racial expectations I had on my career. They all like just came rushing right back. So, you know,
So that's that story. And then you eventually left the show, right?
I left because it wasn't worth it anymore.
Right.
And actually yesterday they just announced that they are closing the show. They just closed the show. So the show no longer exists at Disneyland anyway, but.
So that story, and we could probably do an entire podcast just on that story because it really is a great story, and I was so moved when you wrote it out on social media. But what's interesting about that story to me as an actor and as an artist, outside of the context of just racism in America and just racial expectations and racism in our field, is just the ways in which artists, and not just artists, but people in general, have to constantly learn to measure expectations and constantly learn that we're never out, as long as you're alive, you're never out of the woods with things twisting and turning on you. And in this career, there's so many moments that you have where you feel like, this is it. This is what I've been waiting for. This is the thing. And it's like, you have to learn to like ride that wave with dignity and gratitude and love, and also know that like it's gonna crash down.
Well,
and you're gonna have to learn to deal with the valley in between the peaks.
You specifically have really taught me that lesson specifically. I mean, I remember coming to New York to do a callback for the Once on This Island musical. And I stayed with you in Bushwick. And you in Utah, for all of you listening out there, Austin Archer was like the dude. He was like the dude in Utah. He was like the dude, you know? I mean, I remember you back in high school when you guys did a production of Godspell and we were at some like drama conference. We didn't even go to the same high school, but your drama teacher like introduced you at like this big meeting. And she was like, "And Austin Archer is Jesus." And she put this beat, in there. And she was, "And Austin Archer is Jesus in Godspell." And literally it was an inside joke at our high school. We would always, anytime we would mention Jesus in any way, we'd be like, "Oh, you mean Austin Archer? Cool, cool, cool." Like that's just kind of who Austin was in the Utah theater scene. And I remember going to New York and staying with you
and I was like nobody.
And I was like, "How's it going?" And you're like, "It's bullshit. It's so hard. I fucking hate it. Like, what am I doing?" And I was like, "Okay, Austin needs to calm the fuck down. New York's not that intense. Like, get over yourself." And then when I moved to New York in 2018, I was like, I wasn't the dude of LA, but I had done some fucking... I had some credits.
Yeah.
And so I moved to New York just expecting, right? Just expecting this, like... you know, usually people say, like, "Oh, move to New York when you have all this momentum." And I had this incredible momentum.
Yeah.
And I literally didn't work for a year and a half. And it was soul-crushing. It really, really destroyed me.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was part of this show called Emoji Land, the musical. And I had this lead role. He had four songs, two of which were raps. It was unbelievable. We did it at the musical theater festival thing that no longer exists, RIP.
Yeah.
And then when they moved it to Off-Broadway, they...
Wait, is the New York Musical Theater Festival no longer?
Oh, yeah. It's gone. Yeah.
That's like an institution.
I know. It's wow. no longer, yeah. Wow. They moved Emoji Land to Off-Broadway, and, you know, we were all sort of expecting to have our parts still because it was such a fucking hit. And
sure.
they told, the casting director told my agent, which told me, they said that I'm a nobody, was the quote. And they were looking for stars.
Your agent on the phone. Let me get it right here. I wrote it down. They said that you are, hold on. A nobody.
I mean, you're joking, but that's like found footage. That's exactly how it happened. And to my manager's credit, she was very angry for me. But it really fucked me up. It really, really fucked me up. And I was like, oh, Austin Archer, he nailed it. Like he nailed it. He nailed exactly sort of what coming into New York as an actor with expectations. He just like.
For anyone in the world who feels like they need a little bit of humbling, like who feels like maybe they're like sitting too high on like their horse. Like if you feel like, ooh, I'm having trouble with my ego, move to New York for a couple of years, no matter what you do, like whatever it is that like you're into.
Yeah.
And just like let that city like really like beat you into the pavement. I don't know if it's like that for normal people. Maybe it's just like that for
honestly,
artists. But,
Austin, I think it's incredibly common. In fact, me and my friend Gabriella Milo, this is a pitch. This is a plug-in, by the way. We're writing a TV series called Over It, which is literally about this phenomenon of people moving to New York and New York just like sort of beating the shit out of you. Because that's kind of what it does, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And part of it I think is very character building. It's very like it really tests your mettle. It really, I remember I would stand on my roof in Bushwick and look at the city at night and I would be like, this sounds so stupid.
No.
But I would stand there and I would be like, you are not going to win.
Yeah.
You're not going to beat me.
Yeah.
I'm not going home.
Yeah.
Like I'm heading back in there tomorrow and I'm going to get back to work and like, I'm going back to an audition tomorrow and I'm going to beat you.
Yep.
But it felt like I was in this like, this fight with this place. And I think that there were aspects to me living there that were like, I was very unhealthy while I was living there. And I was like just drinking a lot and and mostly just drinking. And
y'all, Austin Archer's story is incredible. I hope you're as big of a fan of him as I am, but
they know
you've been through a lot, dude, especially in New York, but
But I think that in this career, and I think in many people's lives, I think that the lesson, the hard thing to learn for a lot of people is not how to weather the peaks, but how to weather the valleys.
Yeah.
And like you said, like you were doing well in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You had this premiere show in Frozen. And while you were doing that, you got to go play Usnavi twice at different regional houses.
Yep. I got to do.
Which is like an amazing role.
Spamilton. I did some short films.
That's right.
You did
Spamilton.
Yeah.
I remember watching you online and being like, Cooper's in thing after thing after thing.
Yeah.
And you weren't just like in ensemble. You were always the lead role. You were always playing these principal characters and like you were like boom, 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 boom.
It was great. And there was no, the thing is that nothing changed between LA and New York. Like I was still the same actor, still the same performer. Right.
Right.
It just, I don't know. I don't know. Who knows?
And I want to say, cause part of me is like, well, do you regret leaving Los Angeles? But I also want to say like, I think no matter where you are as an artist, no matter where you live, there's times where you're batting really a high average and like you're like, and you have like a little streak, and there's times where you're just, you have to wait, sit around and wait.
Yeah.
It really is a career of feast or famine.
Yeah.
And that's been my experience at least, is like, there are times where I have more offers on the table than
sure.
I can manage, sure. and I have to say no to several things, sure. and I have to like really weigh what I want to do.
Sure.
And there's times where the phone doesn't ring for 9 months straight, mm-hmm. and when it does, it's for something that I don't really want to do, but yeah. I have to say yes anyway, just yeah. because I gotta do something.
Yeah, you know, if you want a career in the performing arts, you have to do it because you love it. You know, you right. have to do it because you can't do anything else. I remember people coming to my college and saying that during master classes, and I was like, fuck this person. Like, don't yeah. tell me that, you know, but I totally get it. I totally get it. And I also think too, like, no matter where you are, if you're in a peak or a valley, the thing that will bring you down is yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to look at the city from your roof and be like, I am going to get back in there and keep going. And I feel like I got to a point in New York where I was so discouraged and everything just, it was the exact opposite experience as LA. And it got to a point where that I had when I lived in LA. I got to a point where I just like wouldn't even go to auditions or callbacks that I got because I was like, what's the uh-huh. point? What's yep. the point? Like, I don't want to go and like put my heart into this audition packet and then be disappointed. Because in theater especially, like, they don't just tell you no. They actually just ghost you. They just don't uh-huh. tell you anything. And it's yeah. the waiting around for something that doesn't come that is like, it's so painful if you let it be. Right.
Yeah, it's the 2 to 3 weeks where you're sitting around and your parents are calling yeah. and saying, "How'd that thing? Did you get that thing? Did
yeah.
people don't know how it works Mm-mm. too? Where they ask you like the day after, they're like, "So did yeah. you get it? You're like, "Well, hold on.
Yeah,
I won't know for about sure. a week. And then like 2 weeks later, did you get it? You're like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't think so. And then like 4 weeks later, did you get it? You're like, I think I didn't.
Yeah. Get it.
And it's that thing of just kind of like slowly letting go of the hope.
Yeah.
But we talked about this earlier. Oddly enough, one of the things that's been my biggest ally in auditions is when I'm able to get rid of the expectation or yeah. like the, is when I'm able to approach it with a mindset of like, all yeah. good. Like but also I think this is why it's feast or famine is if you put together a couple bookings in a row and you're sort of like working and uh-huh. you sort of got some good momentum going, suddenly auditions are kind of like there's less pressure. You're sure. kind of like, oh, it's all right. Like I've got stuff going on. Sure. I don't need this, but like, and you feel good about yourself. You feel yeah. like, I feel like I'm doing good work right now. Yeah. And so suddenly your attitude toward the audition is like,
right.
is just kind of like, yeah, I'm just going to do what I do. Cause yeah. I'm good. I book, I'm going to do what I do. Yeah. And you don't really have that expectation.
Sure.
And it's when you go a while without getting one that you start to get more and more hungry.
Yep.
And that hunger becomes mm-hmm. a thing that holds you back because
totally.
And it hurts. It hurts so much.
Oh
every
God,
single,
it
every
hurts
new,
so much.
Every new rejection just, and then mm-hmm. I totally went through those exact same periods in New York where I just went, I'm not going anymore. I'm not going.
Yeah.
I can't go for a while.
Yeah.
And I would take a couple months off and I would just be like, I'm just not
going
to go.
My mental health demanded it, actually.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
I look back at that period and was like, you know what? I don't have regrets about it because I just like, I mentally couldn't handle it. But I have two things that I wanted to share with you
sure.
about this. I feel like I've talked so much. I'm sorry.
That's the point. You're the
oh,
guest.
I guess it is a podcast.
Yeah.
But number one is that I specifically have learned this I can't speak English anymore. Continuing to learn this because of the musical Hamilton. So the musical mm-hmm. Hamilton basically has ruined my life, but also given me all of my self-confidence at the same time. I've auditioned yeah. for Hamilton. I think I'm on audition 19 now. Mm-hmm. And when you look at my entire skill set and you look at me as a human being, it almost as if God created Hamilton to fulfill all my dreams, right? So my dream was Broadway, right? And my skill set is, you know, I can sing extremely low and sing extremely high. And I'm like a really, really great dancer. And I can rap like a motherfucker. Like I really, uh-huh. really can. And I'm also mixed race with a little bit of Latino in there. So when Hamilton came out, it wasn't even a matter of like, if I was going to be in it. It was a matter of when I was going to be in it and what part I was going to play. Because there's like five parts in there that I was like, yep, I could do that. Yep, I could do that. Yep, I could do that.
You would kill Lafayette. You would kill Burr. You would kill Hamilton.
Yeah.
And you'd also be great in the Anthony Ramos part, the son.
And I was Anthony Ramos's understudy when I did In the Heights at Pioneer Theater in Utah. He was Sonny, and I was the Sonny understudy. And so watching
Anthony Ramos played Sonny?
Uh-huh.
He didn't play Usnavi?
No, Usnavi was Joseph Morales. So Joseph Morales now is on the Hamilton tour as Hamilton, and Anthony Ramos is, you know,
is the most famous guy in the world.
Ramos, right? Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was there was one performance where Joseph got really, really sick. I think he had laryngitis, and Anthony was going to play Usnavi, and I was Sonny, and we had like all of these rehearsals together, and I was so excited to do it, but regardless, my expectation for being in Hamilton, I put on others, and then others put that expectation on me. Like, oh, Cooper, you're going to be on it. You're going to do it. And then I played Usnavi twice. I did Spamilton, where I played Lin-Manuel playing Hamilton in Hamilton. And when it didn't happen and it continued not to happen for me, I just felt like if they literally created a musical literally for my talents and I can't book that, then what is the point? And I just hated that musical. And I've really had to find sort of my, like, I had to release the expectation that I would be in that show. And the last couple times they brought me in for Lafayette Jefferson, I feel like that's sort of where they've settled, because they brought me in for a whole bunch of shit. And just
you've got a David look going on, kind of.
Yeah. And that's sort of the thing that I love to play too, is like that fun, crazy, character-y, but like slightly villainous side character.
I want to see you with David Diggs' hair. I want to see you that. I want to see that.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. Uh-huh. But going into those auditions and not having any expectations to book it, has allowed me to have fun with it, and having fun with such good material is just, it feeds your soul. So I really like, I'm having this really interesting relationship with Hamilton where it destroyed me, but now it's really like becoming something that's really healing me by having fun. But I also started.
I think that's a perfect. Sorry, I'll let you do the second one.
Oh, sorry.
I just want to say, I think that's a perfect story for this. That having the expectation of like, I'm obviously built and meant to do this thing.
Yeah.
And then having to recontextualize it and be like, actually, I have to learn that it's okay if I don't do that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that I'm like less valuable or less. I had a very similar experience with Book of Mormon, because when I was in New York, it was like, if there's any show on Broadway right now that like I feel like I could just kill, and everyone that I know that sees it is like, you got to be in that show. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I know, how could I not be in it?
Right.
And then to realize like, it's okay if I'm not in it.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I could do it. I know I could do it.
Yeah.
But it's okay if I don't.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
Yeah. Keep going.
Well, actually, I have two more stories.
Okay.
One more real quick about my boyfriend, Gabe. So my boyfriend, Gabriel Violet, he is probably the best singer I've ever heard live in my entire life. And I'm not just like saying that because I live with him and I am in love with him and whatever, but like literally when he opens his mouth to sing, it is like you get that like feeling at the crown of your head and you get tingles in your whole body. Like it's that kind of like magic when he sings. And so Gabe, when he was 19, went to an open call for Spring Awakening in like Chattanooga. He just like walked in and he booked Spring Awakening on Broadway as Otto.
Wow.
So at 19, he literally moved from St. Louis, where he was like homeschooled, to New York City and was on Broadway for like close to a year, right? Just like his entire life changed.
And don't those stories just kill you?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But he had no expectation of being on Broadway. He just loved Spring Awakening and went in and sang. And he hasn't been on Broadway since. And he has the exact opposite sort of problem that I'm having, where people are telling him, okay, well, when are you going to do it again? When are you going to be on Broadway again? When is it going to happen? And it's not like he's not trying, right? And he's people have no sympathy for where I'm at right now, because it's you already achieved that dream. So he's in this really small microcosm of people who've achieved it and are trying to do it again, but can't. And Spring Awakening was a full decade ago, right? So it's interesting, both of us going through these career expectations from the exact opposite angle, and just realizing that it's peaks and valleys, and that it just happens when it happens and it doesn't when it doesn't. It's really, really interesting.
Think about the amount of people that you see who book a lead role or a serious supporting role in a series on TV that goes for six seasons, and those people, you never hear from them again.
Yeah.
And it's for those 6 years, they must have thought, I've done it and I will never come down from this.
Yeah.
I am now a household name.
Yeah.
I am now in people's living rooms every single week for the last 6 years.
Yeah.
And you know, so with Community, it's you've got the Donald Glovers who go off to become Donald Glover.
Yeah.
But then you've got people like Danny Pudi, who's struggling, who's bouncing around on different shows and doing bit parts here and there.
And it's not because he's not trying.
Yeah. And it's not because he's not talented.
Yeah.
It's it's just weird. It's people are oh, but you're so Abed. We can't not see you as Abed.
Right. Right.
Or whatever it is, whatever the reason is, it's that guy has to probably live with the fact that Donald Glover is Donald Glover, and he's going, well, I'm me, and I just have to do what I do.
And listen, it's not because people aren't trying. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I used to think why hasn't this person been on Broadway lately? Or why haven't I seen this person in a movie? And you never go to, oh, they're auditioning and they're just not booking anything. Your mind goes, oh, maybe they wanted to start a family, or maybe they wanted to do something else. But even though you're an actor and you've achieved the heights, you still have to audition for your next job. You still have to keep going. It's still a process.
Right.
But I have this new acting coach. His name is Ben Rappaport. He was in the TV series For the People on ABC. He was in Picnic on Broadway. He was in Ozark in the first season.
Love Ozark.
Yeah, he's the best. He's so awesome and a really, really good friend of mine. And our first, me and Gabe both take acting lessons from him. And on our first day, he gave us a book called New Thoughts for Actors by Jack Plotnick. And I just wanted to read a snippet from it, because it's literally changed my life, not just acting wise, but everything wise. So you open the book and the first thing it says is The Power of Thought. And it says actor affirmations. And it says, my personal favorites for right before an audition or a performance. And here are some bullet points he has. It says, okay. I release and destroy my need to get this job. I am going to take it from where I am, however I'm feeling, and however prepared I am is a fine place to begin this scene. I release and destroy my need to control this scene. I know that I am not strong enough to control it, and therefore ask my higher power to lovingly guide me through it. I am going to approach this scene as if it's the ninth take, like an improv. I release and destroy my need to be an actor. Let the other people here be the actors and have all the responsibilities that come with it. I am just here to be myself and enjoy playing in the circumstances. For a comedy, I release and destroy my need to be funny. I am just here to tickle myself with my own genuine human behavior. For a drama, I release and destroy my need to make choices, but more importantly, I will allow choices to happen to me. And then he says, I release and destroy my need to impress them. I give myself permission to hate them. fuck them. And that literal page has changed my entire life. Like,
is Ben Rappaport a recovering alcoholic or a recovering?
Well, isn't that very similar to AA?
Did he write the book? Or
no, Jack Plotnick wrote the book.
Okay, whoever wrote that book then, because that I released this to my higher power.
And
I
very much.
Oh yeah, I got a big smile on my face when I heard that. Because those literally, that actually sounds like a lot of the meditations that I do, of like, I need to release.
It sounds like step
my,
one.
Need to control this. Yeah, I need to get out of the idea that I'm in control of the result here. Mm-hmm. That like it's really based on like how good or bad I do, whether I get this job or not. It's like it has nothing to do with that. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. Like, and I love the idea of like wherever I'm starting from is fine. It's totally fine. There's no perfect way that I can do this.
Yeah.
And I also love, I release myself from the need to impress them.
Just.
I don't know if I personally will go to that. I'm not mad at them, but I also am just like, it's, yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, I'm also like, it's fine if you guys don't like me.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Or if you just don't like me for this.
Yeah.
You know, like that's totally okay.
Yeah.
That's.
Yep.
Yeah.
And those.
I had a call back the other day with the director on Zoom who like right away, I was like, I don't like this guy.
Yeah.
Like
he
was just kind of like a really like macho guy. Like he was like, all right, Austin, I just want you to try this like a little bit like natural, dude. Like, and I was like,
oh,
and I just was like, I don't like this guy. And I was like, I don't think we're getting along on this Zoom call. But I was also like, that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, that's okay.
Totally.
I don't need to try to like impress him.
No. Yeah. And look like literally that this page has changed my life in many ways. Like, if me and Gabe get in a fight, which happens all the time in quarantine, I think with every relationship, it's like the fight will be over and I'll be mad about it for like a little bit after. And just being like, you know what? I release and destroy my need to be angry right now. And it's amazing how quick it happens. And so applying that to my career, you know, I wouldn't say nothing's happening for me right now. I have a lot of things like, you know, coming up the pipe, but like I just being like, I release my expectation of myself for blank, blank, blank. It allows me to live my life where before I felt like I wasn't able to.
Here's where I think you and I are at right now. And here's where I mean, in a space where like technically it could be considered that we're like riding a valley or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently in the middle of like a little bit of like a streak, which is nice.
Nice.
But I know, but it's little, it's a little one. This whole year has been a valley. Like all of 2020 has been a valley
for everyone, basically.
Yeah. And a lot of 2019 for me was a valley. I haven't done a play in a year and a half, which is the longest amount of time I haven't done a play in my entire adult life.
Yeah.
And so it's almost been 2 years.
Wow.
What I've been doing what I always do is I delve into personal projects, music, writing, all that stuff. And that's what you're doing. And what I've been working on lately with expectation is, and I talked to Chase Ramsey yesterday and we talked about this.
Love him.
We talked about how we feel like we're not doing anything if we're not doing anything quote unquote big.
Sure.
If we're not doing anything that people can, that we can tell other people about and that they'll be impressed by.
Sure.
You know? But we're almost never doing nothing.
Yeah.
And so what I need to do is change my expectation of my work and be like, just because thousands or millions of people aren't going to be in like digesting my work and like appreciating it, and I'm not going to be getting accolades from strangers, and I'm not going to be making a ton of money, doesn't mean that the work isn't valuable and isn't helping me stay connected to my purpose.
Yeah.
And isn't helping me. I need to be able to work in my medium from a place of love and acceptance for who I am and what my limitations are and what my reality is.
That's beautiful.
I need to be able to accept my present state and be happy where I am and not be like, doing this will lead to this, which will lead to this, which will make me happy.
Right.
It's like, no, I am happy because I get to be at home working on music.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
I am happy because I enjoy the process of putting a song together. I love that I get to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And the expectation of a specific result cannot be the determining factor in my happiness and my well-being.
100%. You know? Yep.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
Yeah, so you're well you're said. Working on music right now, which is exciting.
Yeah, and, I'm working on music right now. I mean, Donald Glover is like that is sort of like my career goal, right?
For releasing that expectation. Yeah, who doesn't want to be Donald Glover?
Yeah, but I love that he could do TV and film and produce and write, but also can rap and do music. And those are all skill sets that I have myself. So I'm working on some music, which I sent to you the other day.
It's amazing. I'm not surprised at all by how naturally you take to this. Like, I'm not surprised.
Thanks. And you know what? Yeah. It's super fun. And so at least at the very least, I'm having a lot of fun doing it. Again, I'm writing that TV series with my friend Gabby Milo, which is all about, hot ass mess actors who are trying to put their lives together by writing a TV show. So it's very meta. I'm working on some stuff with Gabe, and I'm also trying to start a new theater company in Salt Lake City with a couple friends. So that's been taking up a lot of time, and I'm really doing...
So you're busy.
Yeah, I'm doing things that really feed my soul, and I'm not just sitting at home wondering why I haven't made it and what is wrong with me and whatnot, you know? So
I mean, it's hard to ever have that stuff completely turn off, for me at least.
100%.
That stuff's, it's always there,
the comparison
which is why
game.
I have to do.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I have to do daily work. I have to make sure that I'm staying healthy so that I can stay in a place of gratitude and presence and acceptance.
Yeah.
Because even talking to Chase Ramsey, it's like, he's like, well, I wish I was doing what you're doing. And I'm like, Chase, you're doing
you're
a million things right now
that
I want to do. But we always, the comparison game, it's like, we always, well, I'm not doing what that person's doing. I'm not. And it's like that thing and comparing and having expectations that aren't being met will always be the thing that keep me from staying present and staying in a place where I can accept that the life I have is abundant and full, and I have more than enough love.
Yeah.
I have more than enough creative fulfillment.
Right.
I have, you know, the thing that's lacking is like, I'm not getting the desired response. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, I don't think my brain really knows what the desired response is, because I'm fairly certain that if a day ever comes where I get to be a big supporting character in like a Quentin Tarantino movie, or I get to do Broadway, I'm going to find myself going, oh, this also feels somewhat empty.
Yeah.
If I'm not internally okay.
Yeah.
If I'm not staying internally grateful and present, then I think that those things will continue to be unfulfilling.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. I remember on our mission president, my LDS Mormon mission, my mission president would always say this thing where he was like, you need to be where you are when you're there. You need to be where you're at when you are there. And I took it for granted on my mission all the time. But in my life now, and especially in quarantine, it's like, I need to be in this moment doing the thing that I'm doing and not have my expectations or my heart or my brain like three steps ahead of me while I'm living in like a what if land, you know?
Yep. Yep.
So
the last thing I want to talk to you about, and because my laptop's going to die, but I want to just hit this one last thing, and it's a big thing.
Yeah.
We could talk about, I think we could go on like this for a long time, but I do want to hit this last thing because it's a big thing for me lately, which is I have to, and I'm working on this currently, I have to ditch my expectations of other people's behavior.
Yeah.
Because I get really hurt by other people not behaving the way that I want them to behave, especially in an election year and in a year like this, where I just am like, how can you think the things that you think or behave the way that you behave? If my well-being and my security is attached to other people's behavior, I'm doomed.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make it. And I have to allow other people to be other people and really focus. How do you feel about that? About letting go of expectations of other people?
I think it's incredibly difficult. I think it's interesting being a New Yorker and being a Democrat, because you just sort of figure that everyone should be that way. You know,
sure.
It doesn't make sense for me to be a Republican at all. But I remember having a conversation with my mom after the 2016 election. And she told me that she voted for Donald Trump. And I love my mom. My mom is like basically the most perfect person on the planet. She's just she is the most Christian person I've ever met, you know, full of love, love thy neighbor.
True sense,
in a
Christ-like.
True sense. Yeah. Christ-like. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And her explaining to me why she voted for Donald Trump, which was wild to me. It just was wild. But listening to her and still loving her, even though I didn't agree with her decision, really taught me how to love a person coming from a different viewpoint. Now, it's a little different in 2020, because if you are voting for Donald Trump again or now because of the things that have happened just in 2020 alone, there's a lot of things that I will question about who you are as a person.
Yeah.
But, and there are some people that I know, and probably my mom, I don't know, we haven't talked about it yet, but that I know that are voting for Donald Trump again. And it's just, it's too hard to live a life where you cancel people because they don't agree with your opinion. We have to live in a world where we can love people even when they don't act the way that we expect them to, because that's just what the world is. So,
and I think that it doesn't mean that we can't be clear with people. It doesn't mean that we can't let people know, hey, when you do this, it makes me feel like this.
Right.
Like we can use I feel statements or not, it makes me feel, I feel hurt when you act like this because of this, or I feel, it makes me feel less valued when, you know, but I think you've done this online where you've said like, in my opinion, voting for this man means that you don't value my rights and things. And it's that kind of thing of being clear with people about this is what it means to me that you support him.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to be clear about that without making it about. It's hard for me to word it, but being direct in love about what you want, but also allowing people to have to make their own decisions.
And, you know, I think a lot of people, especially the ones that we grew up with in Utah, again, grew up I remember living in Utah and having many conversations with many white people about how racism doesn't exist anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because there were no other races. There was a whole world experiencing a thing that was happening that no one in Utah had access to, you know?
Right.
And so being able to hear my Utah friends and hear their unintentional racism that they have and voting for Donald Trump and being like, okay, well, this is the world that you grew up with. You have no experience with this thing. And either you are hearing the thing I have to say about it or you're not hearing it. You know, you just kind of have to, just see people and meet people and love people from where they're coming at right now. You know, you got to meet people where they're at. So I feel like that's sort of, I'm not perfect at it, but sort of my MO and what I'm trying to do. But, you know,
absolutely,
it's hard on social
media.
That
face I just made, by the way, is my niece came in wearing my mom's wedding dress, which I didn't even know my mom still had that, I guess.
Oh,
but,
my gosh,
yeah,
that's
like,
amazing.
But it was crazy.
I want to try on a wedding dress.
I know. I'm like, they're playing dress up and I want to go play. You're spot on with that. And again, I think we could talk about this forever. My computer's
going
to die. I am so glad that you were willing to do this with
this
me.
Yeah, this was great.
I wish that I saw you more often.
Yeah.
I love you so much.
I'll see
and
you soon.
And I always just, I look up to you a lot.
Oh,
and I admire your tenacity and your work ethic
Thank
and
you.
Your stick-to-itiveness and your, just, I think that you've had a very enviable career
thank
for what
you.
It's worth.
Thank you.
And I think that you've, been able to do a lot of really, really cool things, and you have a lot to be proud of.
Thanks, Austin. And I appreciate that.
And I think you have a lot ahead of you as well. So
thank you.
Yeah, without putting any specific expectation on it, I just think you're going to be okay, you know? And that's like, that's thank the you. One expectation that I always plan on living with, is that I'm like, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, you
if
are.
If the Yellowstone volcano goes off, I'm going to be fine.
Yep.
It's all good.
Uh-huh.
If I die in the volcanic ash, it's all good.
Whatever happens, like, happens. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a great life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Awesome.
Cool. All right, man. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Austin.
So yeah, man, that's really what it comes down to for me, is that the only expectation I really want to have out of life is that I'm going to be all right. You're all going to be all right. We're all going to be all right, you know? It's going to be okay. We're going to deal with some hard shit, and it's going to suck. And it's going to suck when it sucks, and it's going to be cool when it's cool. We're going to go on some cool vacations. We're going to hear some cool music. We're going to see some cool movies, eat some good food, laugh pretty hard at some good jokes, have some boring days, some days where not a lot happens, like a lot of moments where just like not a lot's going on, you know? And that's it. I mean, that's it. That's my expectation for life, is like, it's going to be okay. I don't know if that's like quite the Zen goal of it all for like really enlightened people, is to realize that like, whatever, it's all good. I'm not quite sure that that's like the state of enlightenment that people are shooting for, but like, for me right now, that's gonna work. That'll work. Maybe there's a higher plane that I'll get to at some other point, but I don't know. Yeah, Cooper's great, man. Yeah, he's a good guy, and I'm really glad I'm friends with him, and I'm glad that he did that. You know, keep an eye out for him. He's gonna keep doing stuff. He's gonna keep doing cool things. He's very talented, and whether it's Hamilton or something else, he's gonna do something. So, you know, keep your eyes on him. Yeah, okay. That's it. Again, you can go listen to me on TJTV. It's on Spotify. Capital TJAY space TV. It's a podcast that I was the guest on. I think the episode's just called Austin Archer. You can also listen to me on the Lost Boys podcast. I think it's called, that show is called Deep Talks and Poppycock. That is on Apple Podcasts and other platforms. And again, the episode I think is called Who the Hell is Austin Archer, or like Who is Austin Archer, something like that. Go listen to me there. Listen to my album if you haven't yet. I mean, what are you doing? If you're a person who listens to this podcast every single week and you haven't listened to my album yet, that hurts my feelings. You should go listen to the album. It's available everywhere. Beautiful Things by Austin Archer. Purchase the album through Bandcamp. I really want everyone to consider purchasing it through Bandcamp. It's not iTunes. If you're thinking of purchasing the album, don't purchase through iTunes. Purchase through Bandcamp. Bandcamp gives a much better profit share to artists. iTunes gives pretty much nothing to artists. But also, I want that profit share that Bandcamp's offering, because I'm also donating a portion of the proceeds for this record to suicide prevention. So you can help support your boy, Austin Archer. You can support independent music and independent art in a really difficult year for independent artists, and you can also support mental health and suicide prevention, all in one big swing. For $10, you can buy that record and do all those things. AustinArcherMusic.bandcamp.com. Search Austin Archer wherever you stream music. Austin-Archer.com is my website. You know, all the things. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. The show's mixed and mastered by Chrissy Bear over at Marmalade Music. Chris Bjorn. Go to marmalademusicslc.com. Let them know that you listen to People Pleaser and that you love the work that Chris does on this show. And Chris will give you 20% off of your first audio project. So if you have a project that you need mixed and mastered, I know Cooper Howell does. I know Cooper Howell has some music that he's making. Cooper, if you go to Chris and you tell him that you're a fan, of People Pleaser and of his work. He's going to give you 20% off, my guy. And anyone else that's making music or doing their own audio projects, MarmaladeMusicSLC.com. Chris is the best in the biz, and he's just a really sweet guy too, and a lot of fun. He just moved into a new space and got a new studio. We're really excited for him for that. Hit him up and work with him. I think that's it for me this week. Love y'all. See you next week. Take care of yourselves. Ta-ta.